From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. As voters hit the booths across the country today, a new debate is boiling about the reliability of new voting technologies. A number of computer scientists are warning that electronic voting may be the dangling chad, or worse, of the future. Tonight on Point, the push for electronic voting and the national debate over its reliability or vulnerability. But first, we begin in Washington with an overview of the day's key election contests. Eleanor Clift is a contributing editor for Newsweek magazine. She joins us live with the latest. Good evening, Eleanor. What are you watching?
Good evening.
Hi. What are you watching? What are you seeing?
What am I watching? What am I seeing? I'm seeing the Republican trends in the South solidifying. The Republican candidate is surely going to win in Kentucky, far ahead, and in Mississippi, it's a more closely contested contest, but it's a very heavily Republican state, and it would be amazing if the Democrat pulls out a victory. So I think we see a 50-50 divided nation, the red states and the blue states, and I think the trends today will simply reinforce that impression.
Eleanor, let's look at Kentucky first, if we may. Governor Paul Patton, Democrat, reached his term limit there. A Republican, Ernie Fletcher, congressman, went up against State Attorney General Ben Chandler. How does it seem to be playing out?
Well, the polls all indicated that Congressman Fletcher was way ahead of the Democratic candidate who is serving as the Attorney General and who is the grandson of a former popular figure in the state, Governor Happy Chandler. And it's amazing that he hasn't been able to get any traction because of the hangover from the scandal from Governor Patton. In a way, it's reminiscent of the Clinton years. Governor Patton had to admit that he was having an affair while he was in office. And apparently that has really scandalized Mississippi voters, and they're taking it out on the Democratic successor, probably
voters,
much the way Al Gore feels. he was punished in 2000.
Mm-hmm. So it looks like a Republican victory there. In Mississippi, Haley Barbour at this hour, can we tell anything from exit polls? How's it look for him?
It's very tight in Mississippi, and Haley Barbour is a former Republican National Party chairman, and all the leading figures of the Republican Party, the president, the vice president, have all been in Mississippi campaigning for him. The Democratic incumbent governor was initially given no chance, but he has come back with a theme that that Barbour is really a Washingtonian, that he's abandoned Mississippi, that he really is not in tune with average voters in the state, and he has battled to the point where the race is even. So I think that's going to be a little hard to call until later this evening.
President Bush has been in Mississippi three times working to help Haley Barbour on that campaign.
That's right. And the president, I think, if there's a signal here, it's an indication of how hard he's going to work for himself and for other Republicans next year, because the Republicans had a stunning success in the 2002 Senate elections because the president barnstormed key states in the last 72 hours, and he put many of those candidates over the top. So I think by getting so heavily involved in these two states, I think he's suggesting that he is certainly willing to put his political capital on the line when he thinks a Republican can win.
Eleanor, big mayoral races in three cities at least, Philadelphia, Houston, San Francisco. Have you been watching those races?
Well, Philadelphia, it's interesting. John Street, the incumbent mayor, an African-American, there are many questions about his leadership. And then a couple of weeks ago, it was discovered that an FBI bug had been planted in the city mayoral headquarters, and that has really rebounded to his advantage. I think people are offended by the tactics of the FBI. They're not really quite sure what the probe is about, and he's running against a Republican businessman. I know the last name is Katz. I can't remember the first name.
Sam Katz.
Sam Katz, right, mm-hmm. Exactly. And so I think there, Mayor Street was given up for dead not long ago, it looks like he could pull this one out.
So the FBI listening devices may actually redound to his benefit.
Absolutely. And I don't know if you or any of your viewers watch the HBO series K Street, mm-hmm. but it's
this
a sort of stream of consciousness mix of fiction and and reality. Mm-hmm. And about the only story thread in that HBO series is the fighting off of an FBI probe, and they're really playing off of the street episode.
So the world of fiction and the world of reality intersecting there. Houston, it's Mayor Lee Brown, Democrat, reached his term limit, and Bill White is up, Democrat, up against Orlando Sanchez, Republican. It's been a pretty tough battle there.
Yeah, and here the incumbent mayor, I believe, is African American, and one of the candidates is Hispanic, and the whole ethnic politics always comes into play. And Houston is certainly not majority black, and so it was a great victory when an African American was able to win. And I'm sure everybody's going to be measuring the ethnic turnout in this race as a Republican Hispanic is trying for the office.
And what about San Francisco? Willie Brown, also at his term limit. Any indication of who's coming behind him?
Well, there's a zoo out there. I mean, they make the nine candidate Democratic field look small. There are a number of candidates, and frankly, I don't know who's emerging, and the likelihood is that there will be a runoff between the two top vote-getters, because it's highly unlikely that anyone will reach the threshold of victory.
But still early in California, maybe a runoff there December 9th. But overall, Eleanor, you're drawn to this 50-50 nation as a couple of states in the South go Republican. What do you think it means for the upcoming presidential election season?
I think it means that we're going to have a really hard-fought presidential contest because of the tightness of the numbers, and the evidence is that the swing voters may not be the most crucial constituency next year, that each side is going to be struggling to get out their core voters, that a lot of people in the middle have chosen sides, that we are perhaps more polarized, more divided than we were in the year 2000, and so I think you're going to see probably a race that's going to be pretty mean-spirited, not only on the issues, but I'm sure there are going to be some cultural messages sent out, particularly on the Republican side, that are going to be divisive.
Well, we will brace ourselves for that.
Right.
Eleanor Clift, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Eleanor Clift is a contributing editor for Newsweek magazine. She joined us from Washington. After the Florida hanging Chad debacle of 2000, Congress passed the Help America Vote Act to push counties across the country to upgrade to the best available voting practices and technologies. Nothing is quite as easy to use as touchscreen electronic voting machines, and states like Maryland and Georgia have bought them by the thousands, but others like California have put a hold on any new purchases because of warnings by prominent computer scientists that electronic voting machines are too easy to tamper with. Question tonight is, would you trust an electronic vote that has no paper record, no recourse to a recount? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Paul DeGregorio. He's incoming commissioner for the Election Assistance Commission, which is charged with overseeing implementation of the Help America Vote Act of 2002. Good evening and welcome, Paul DeGregorio.
Good evening, Tom.
Thanks for being with us. Also with us tonight from Stanford, California, is David Dill, professor of computer science at Stanford University and founder of VerifiedVoting.org, an organization devoted to ensuring that electronic voting machines include a paper record. Good evening and welcome, Professor Dill.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. Paul DeGregorio, to you first, if we may, put all of this into context for us. Where does the country stand in responding to what we saw in the year 2000 when everything seemed to hang on hanging chads and there was a great hue and cry of how voting equipment had fallen behind the demands being made on it? What percentage of the country has turned over to a higher quality machine than was the norm in 2000?
Well, Tom, there's been significant change in the country in election reform since the election of November 2000. Many states took initiatives on their own. I was chairman of the Missouri Commission on Election Reform, but most states had some kind of commission or committee that looked into the election process in their own states to see if they can improve it. And many states took action on their own. Florida certainly did. Georgia did by mandating new election equipment and getting rid of punch card voting. The federal government took an initiative a year ago this past week. Congress passed the Help America Vote Act, mm-hmm. which is going to make many changes and commit the federal government for the very first time in American history to provide technical assistance and funding to improve the election process throughout the United States. And it's an important piece of legislation, and it mandated that each state shall come up with a plan to obtain some of the federal money that's being dangled out there in front of the states to obtain to change voting systems, to improve voter registration, training of poll workers, and all those kinds of different things that go in to conducting an election throughout the country, and particularly at the state and local level. There's been, quite a bit of change in technology where, a great good percentage of the country voted by punch card in 2000. That changed in 2002 when many states got rid of it. And here we are in 2003, election night 2003, and there's still perhaps 17-20% of the country voting by punch card, but people have turned to new types of technology, including the one that you mentioned earlier in the intro to the program, the touchscreen system. But many states, such as New York, Connecticut, they're going to devote most of the money they're going to get from the federal government to replacing their lever machines and other type machines. Just so you know, in a snapshot, the federal government has released about $630 million already to the states. They received it last June. And this new commission that I'm about to go on, the Senate had a hearing on our nominations. There's four of us, two Democrats and two Republicans. They had our hearing on our nominations last Tuesday. The committee voted it out last Friday. And we may be confirmed tonight. You never know. But it's on the calendar for the Senate to take up before they adjourn, and perhaps as early as this week. The rest of the money that's been appropriated for last fiscal year, $832 million, cannot be released until this commission's in place. So everybody's anxious for this commission to be in place so we can release $832 million. And then in addition to all this, the Congress is appropriating money for this fiscal year, and we may see somewhere between a half a billion and $1 billion appropriated for this fiscal year to give to the states to help improve the election process.
Paul DeGregorio, let me ask you, what percentage of the country is now voting on electronic voting machines, and what percentage do you think will be when all this money has been spent?
Well, the bill calls for the money to be appropriate over a four-year period, and so we're looking at 2006 before we might see, the real change from HAVA. But I think that you're going to see increasing percentages right now, depending on the system we're talking about. But in a touchscreen system, there may be, and David may have more statistics on this than I do, David Dill, but in touchscreen voting, from what I understand, it's between 10 and 20% of the jurisdictions are moving in that direction. Many are choosing optical scan systems, and there's other forms of actually punch card that people are using still. But,
and in a word, are you worried about electronic voting machines being vulnerable to mistakes, to tampering?
Well, let me tell you, Tom, this commission has a role in this process, and I don't want to form an opinion until I get all of the information from David Dill and from other people, academics and technology people, vendors, election officials, constituency groups, to understand what all the issues involved here. This commission will have a technology guidelines development committee of 15 people. The chairman will be from the National Institute of Standards and Technology. They will have about a year to report to the commission, the EAC.
So you're going to wait and see. We've got that picture, David. We've just got 30 seconds before the first break here. We'll talk more. But you are concerned about the vulnerability of these machines. Is that right?
Yes, definitely. I have a low-tech analogy I like. Suppose that you had, when you went to vote, there were no computers involved. You went and there was a curtain, and you dictated your votes to a man behind the curtain who wrote them down. When you were done, you left without having a chance to examine the ballot or make sure that he wrote the right thing. Most people wouldn't be comfortable with that process, and I think that's morally equivalent to what we're moving to.
Paul DeGregorio, thanks for joining us tonight. Looks like a big debate's going to be in your lap soon. We appreciate your overview tonight. Paul DeGregorio is incoming commissioner of the Election Assistance Commission. David Dill, please stand by. We're talking tonight about the new push to electronic voting and the national debate over its reliability or vulnerability to tampering. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the new push to electronic voting machines and the national debate over their reliability or vulnerability to tampering. We just heard from Paul DeGregorio, the incoming commissioner for the Election Assistance Commission, a lot of money going into these reforms and rehab and updating of equipment this year and in the upcoming years. You can join the conversation tonight. Did you vote today? Was it a punch ballot, an optical scan, or a touchscreen electronic voting machine? And did you think twice about the security of your vote or not? Would you trust an electronic vote count that had no paper record, no recourse to a recount? And should the vote verification bar be higher for electronic voting? Is there a tampering risk here? Is there a credibility risk here? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined by David Dill. He's a professor of computer science at Stanford University and the founder of verifiedvoting.org. David Dill, I think a lot of voters would assume, look, we can do many things with computers. Surely we can make a computer, an electronic voting system that can take the vote as I deliver it on the screen and properly record it and conveniently spit it back out for a tally. You're saying it's as uncertain as tossing a word through a curtain to someone who you don't see, who may or may not write it down right? How can that be?
When you are trusting a computer, you're trusting the person who programmed that computer to do it right and to do it honestly, and you're having to trust anybody who might have had access to the software before it got installed on the computer. It may not be obvious, but it turns out that it's surprisingly difficult to make sure that the code you think is running on the machine is what's actually running on the machine. So far as I know, with current computer technology, it's practically impossible to solve that problem. So computers are a lot less trustworthy than you think, especially if there is an incentive for people to try to tamper with them, especially if those people are insiders. My concern is that if elections are held on this type of equipment, we'll never really know about the results of the elections. The worst case scenario is that everything appears to go perfectly smoothly, but the votes that are recorded are actually wrong, and the wrong people win the elections. There's no way to go back and check that those elections are sound.
What's actually happening around the country now as counties and localities look to new machinery? We see that Georgia now has electronic voting machines, that Maryland, after some debate, seems to be now confirmed on that path as well. In other locales, not so. I'm reading here Warren Slocum, chief election officer in San Mateo County in California, saying, "I'm deeply concerned about this whole idea of election integrity related to electronic voting machines." Where does this stand? Where's the debate stand, David Dill?
The debate is in a state of high flux. A lot of the local purchasing decisions are not driven by the argument about the integrity of electronic voting machines, but by more prosaic concerns about financing and whatever. But it is a big issue now, and it's not resolved.
So give us a scenario. How do you see this might go wrong? I mean, presumably, there would be some kind of oversight of how the machines are programmed, and they'd be delivered to take the vote and give it back credibly. How could it get mixed up?
Well, I think everybody assumes that somebody is taking care of this problem. And when you look into it, first of all, it's not possible to solve the problem, even with the best procedures. And the procedures that are in place for inspecting and certifying the machines are wholly inadequate for ensuring computer security. Diebold, one of the major manufacturers of these machines, accidentally left their source code and a lot of their programs lying on the web where people could look at them. They were analyzed, and it was found that they made really stunningly incompetent blunders in the computer security design of their programs. These programs, these systems, were said to be the best that the Independent Testing Authority had reviewed. So I think that the current system is wholly inadequate for ensuring the integrity of the machines.
So in practical terms, how might tampering occur? I mean, could someone just walk into a voting booth and somehow tamper with the machine, or would you need some central control over who's minding the code? How might it work?
Well, the thing that's hardest to stop would be if somebody with access to the software at a vendor, say a programmer or a system administrator who has all the passwords on the computers, made some little change or seemingly minor change that could change votes during the election. That could be done in a very clever way so that it wouldn't be detected by inspection of the software or by testing. Computers are also at the stage where we can't prevent bugs in software. They happen, and we can't get rid of them. So it's entirely possible that there could be accidental changes in votes that wouldn't be detected.
So what are you recommending, then, that we not use computers for voting, or that the paper record, a paper record that would be simultaneous to the electronic vote, be there to confirm for a recount?
I don't want to specify the exact technology. I want to offer a guideline, an abstract requirement, which we call a voter verifiable audit trail. So this is what this requires is that the voter have a chance to check the record that is made of their vote and that that record be permanent so that it can't be changed after it's checked by the voter. So a natural way to do that is with paper. If we go back to the man behind the curtain analogy, if you had a possibly untrustworthy guy filling out a ballot for you, but after he filled it out, he handed it to you and you could put it in the ballot box, or you watch him put it in the ballot box after you've checked it, we'd have a pretty good system. So we can do that in a variety of ways. You can do it with optical scan ballots, because the voter verified audit trail is the ballot filled out by the voter himself or herself.
Optical scan, like the test taking that everybody's familiar with, where you fill in the oval with the pencil or the marker.
Yeah. Sometimes they have broken arrows. That's mm-hmm. how it works where I just voted today. Mm-hmm. The other solution, which hasn't been tested out a lot in the field, is to put voter verifiable printers on the side of touchscreen machines. After you put your vote into the touchscreen machine, the printer prints it on a piece of paper, which you can then check, and that paper is saved. You can't carry it away. It's saved at the polling place for use in a recount later, can be meaningful.
Is that the norm today with the machines that are being bought and sold? Or do they have this verifiability factor?
No, there are a couple of small vendors who have machines like this, and some of the major vendors are working, have prototypes of it. But so far as I know, it's not in regular use in any part of the country. It's been used in some trials.
David Dill, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Dan Tokaji. He joins us from Columbus, Ohio. He's a professor of law at Ohio State University. He's one of the attorneys in the case that challenged the use of punch cards in the recent California recall vote. Good evening and welcome, Dan Tokaji.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
Thanks very much for joining us. Dan, you're very well aware of the debate that's going on over electronic voting machines. At the same time, you're really concerned about some of the deficiencies in old voting methods. How do you see this? Should we be waiting for better electronic methods, or is it time to forge ahead?
I think we need to forge ahead. While I share some of the concerns that David Dill expressed, I am much more concerned than I think he is about the terrible state of our existing voting technology. In many counties throughout the country, we're still using voting machines that should have been retired with the horse and buggy. In the last California election, the California recall election, for example, an estimated 160,000 to 170,000 votes were lost because of the continuing use of outdated punch card systems that I don't think anybody can reasonably defend anymore. The question then is what sort of system we move to. The question is raised, well, are there security concerns with DRE systems?
Meaning
touchscreen systems,
right.
Direct record electronic.
Mm-hmm.
Sure there are. But there are also security concerns with paper-based systems like optical scans or punch cards. And American history is replete with examples from Chicago to San Francisco to Texas to everywhere else in the country of paper being manipulated. We think of paper as a security blanket, but it is not a good one. Paper is no guarantee against fraud. At the same time, where I agree with Dr. Dill is that we have to make sure that with touchscreen systems, just like any other kind of system, we've got adequate security guarantees in place. That means rigorous testing ahead of time before they go into place. It means testing such as what's called logic and accuracy testing to make sure that these things function as they're actually supposed to. We need redundant backups. One debate that I think is an interesting one, brought to light by the recent developments regarding Diebold, is whether or not code should be open source. I think that is an interesting subject, and it would be helpful for us to discuss that issue further of whether source code should be open. What I'm concerned about is that some of the folks, the computer scientists who are advocating a paper trail or some other sort of voter verifiable audit trail,
yes,
don't have a great sense of the checks that are in place in the real world, about the problems with other systems, paper-based systems in the real world, and in particular have failed to give adequate attention to the fact that DRE systems are, that is, touchscreen systems, in terms of ease of use, in terms of access for people with disabilities, in terms of access for people whose first language is not English, in terms of reducing the alarming racial disparity in uncounted votes, DRE systems are superior to the other systems out there in these respects.
David Dill, how about it? Dan Tokaji says there's an awful lot that's arguing to move ahead with these electronic systems. You better have a pretty strong argument against it if you want to slow that change down.
Well, I think I have a strong argument. While it is true that there has been a lot of fraud with paper-based systems, we've had 100 years of experience with paper-based systems. We know how to prevent fraud by having the process be observable by people with a variety of different interests, different political parties, et cetera. In a well-run election, paper-based systems can be extremely secure. We don't have to stick with punch cards. In California, due to Dan Tokaji's court case, we have to get rid of them by March 2004. Mm-hmm. I think that's great. We can upgrade to, say, optical scan systems without having to deal with the admittedly terrible punch card systems that people are still using.
So you're saying there are real alternatives here. You don't have to go that way. Dan Tokaji, let me put that question to you about paper. I mean, you're dismissive of it. And, of course, it's not perfect. But I have to say, you know, I've seen in elections around the world, townspeople defend a box of paper ballots with their lives to get it to some central counting place where the box could be opened, the seal could finally be broken, and the actual vote, they could feel pretty comfortable because they had watched it and there was the paper. They could really know what had gone on. If it just goes into the black box of a computer, what's to prevent some kind of invisible tampering that leaves everybody kind of uncertain about what the actual outcome was?
Well, I think your example crystallizes the point. With paper-based systems, they're secure if you have adequate precautions in place. And the same is true of electronic systems. You got to have adequate precautions in place. And this is one point on which I think David and I agree emphatically. Where we disagree is are maybe in the nuances of exactly what kind of precautions you have to have in place to make electronic voting safe. I guess I'm a bit more optimistic than him in the sense that, you know, it's true we've had instances of fraud with paper-based systems in the past, but as your example points out, most of the time it works. That has a lot to do with the fact that in counties and states throughout the country, we have election administrators, conscientious election administrators, working hard to guarantee the safety of our system. We have volunteer poll workers coming in and doing their civic duty. And for the most part, these folks are honest and these folks are adhering to security guidelines. The same thing can happen with electronic systems. And indeed, it's not as though nobody's tried electronic systems. In Riverside, California, for example, they implemented a DRE system in 2000. It's worked tremendously well so far. And a court case on which some of Professor Dill's cohorts worked to challenge that system was rejected. The Ninth Circuit rejected a challenge to touchscreen systems there, recognizing that, hey, there is a risk with any system and that the people challenging touchscreens had totally failed to show that they were any less reliable than other systems out there.
But here we are hearing from John Rodstrom in famously Broward County, Florida, saying he wants his local officials to upgrade to optical scanning, but they're being pressured to go ahead with the 5,000 touchscreens. Everybody understands we need a better solution here than hanging chads.
But I think optical scan machines, these are the old SAT-type fill-in-the-bubble or ones where you use a pencil or some other kind of writing device to mark a line. I mean, I agree with Professor Dill that they're a lot better than the old punch card machines. They're not as good as touchscreen machines. They don't, first of all, do nearly as good a job of accommodating people with disabilities such as dexterity limitations or visual limitations. They're also not nearly as good in terms of accommodating multi-language voters. And the evidence that we have so far suggests that at least some models of these optical scans don't do anything about narrowing the black-white disparity in uncounted votes.
Lots of issues to weigh here. Dan Takaji, David Dill, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Scott Ananian. He joins us from Arlington, Massachusetts. Good evening and welcome, Scott Ananian.
Good evening, Tom.
Hi. You are a graduate student in computer science at MIT, is that right?
Yes, I am.
And you are in the middle of an interaction with the electronic voting machine maker Diebold, based in Ohio. Can you tell us what's going on there, Scott?
Well, Dan said electronic systems are secure with adequate quick cautions in place, and I think this is clearly an example where inadequate cautions are not in place. So it's Diebold's software that controls their voting machines was left on an unprotected website, and memos detailing the bugs in their system were leaked to several journalists in early August, and the results are kind of horrifying, actually.
What have you seen in those memos, Scott?
Well, so you know, there's a lot of evidence of machines just not operating correctly. So a memory card which recorded negative 16,022 votes for Gore in the November elections, right? So Dan said, 170,000 votes were lost due to lever machines. Well, 62,000 votes were, but caught at the last minute, lost due to electronic voting, to this touchscreen voting machine.
So these are internal memos talking about flaws in the software. What else did you see in those memos, Scott?
There's a sort of appalling lack of respect for the certification process, which has also been brought up as one of the salvations, for electronic machines. Electronic machines are fine because we've got someone smart to look at them and make sure they're okay. Completely uncertified software was used in a number of elections, and as a matter of fact, this past week, Alameda County in California halted certification of the latest Diebold machine after it became obvious that they had potentially used uncertified software in their last election.
Scott, Diebold is, of course, refuting a number of these problems and is coming after you and others for having this memo up on the Internet.
Yeah, so I did post a copy of these memos on my website because I thought that this was something which clearly every American should know about. I mean, the election process is kind of fundamental to our democracy, and things which impact the election process are, the public interest of every American, and as an American, I feel like it should be well known.
And if it's not fixed, Scott, what concerns do you have as a young voter about what we could see here?
Well, I think David Dill is better has already really spoken of that. The problem is that we want to be able to trust our elected officials, and we want the public to have confidence that those elected officials were elected with by an open and transparent process.
You're a young computer guy. Will you have that confidence with electronic voting machines?
Well, I watched my computer crash enough times to be wary of anything with a power switch on it.
Scott Ananian, thanks for joining us tonight. Scott Ananian is a graduate student in computer science at MIT. MIT received a cease and desist letter from Diebold on October 28th saying, get those memos down. Dan Takaji, David Dill, stand by. We're talking tonight about the new push to electronic voting in the national debate over its reliability or vulnerability to tampering. You can join the conversation tonight. What's worse, hanging chads or a computer count that might be manipulated? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the new push to electronic voting machines and the national debate over the reliability or vulnerability of that new technology. My guests tonight are Dan Takaji. He's a professor of law at Ohio State University. He joins us tonight from Columbus, Ohio. From Stanford, California, David Dill, professor of computer science at Stanford, who has raised a heck of a ruckus along with other prominent computer scientists about the potential vulnerabilities here. You can join the conversation as well. Is caution on electronic voting just paranoid fear, or is it justified? Is the shadow of doubt over electronic voting any greater than the shadow that's always been over any voting system? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Dan's calling from New York City. Hi, Dan. You're on the air.
Thank you. My question is, why aren't mechanical lever voting machines being considered as replacements for paper ballots? Because it seems to me that the mechanical machines are pretty reliable and tested, and they've been around for many years. And if they aren't being considered as replacements for paper ballots, then what, if any, objections have been raised regarding them?
So natural. Let's consider the good old lever. Dan Tokaji, can you speak to that?
Yeah, I could speak a little bit of it. You know, I actually think that in some respects, lever machines are better than some of the technology that's more commonly used right now, like punch cards. And in fact, there was a study done that came out sometime in the past year, which showed that in terms of the racial disparity that is resulting in more black loss votes than white loss votes, lever machines, along with electronic machines, actually do much better than either optical scan machines or punch card machines. I think the concerns with lever machines have to do with ease of use, with their non-user friendliness. There may as well be security concerns with those kinds of machines, and maybe Professor Dill can comment on those.
David Dill?
Yeah, I hate lever machines. They do have the same security problem. They don't have a voter verifiable audit trail. The counters click up, and that's the only record of the vote. They are subject to wear in the little gears, so they hit 99 and don't count up any further. So they are more maintainable. They're less complicated in some sense than computers, but I'd prefer to get rid of them.
So yeah. You really want that paper record. Donna's calling from Boston. Hi, Donna. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you.
Sure.
I'm curious as to if touchscreens and computers are safe enough and secure enough for banking, mm-hmm. how difficult is it going to be to make it safe enough for voting? Voter registration cards could be credit card size with a data strip on the back.
Yeah, my view is that I think that they can be made safe enough for voting. And in response to the MIT student who was on before, you know, I applaud the work that he's actually doing to try to expose what he perceives to be security flaws in Diebold's touchscreen system. I think we need more of that, and I think my personal opinion is that the actions that Diebold is taking against him are despicable. I think we need more free speech on this issue, not less. Having said that, we also need to pay attention to the concerns of the disability rights community and other voting rights advocates who see DREs as the best answer.
I don't want to lose Donna's question because it really needs to end up with David Diller, but while you're on Diebold, let's just go to that. We tried to get Diebold to come on this show and speak to some of the questions that have been raised. They did not provide anyone force, but they did say that if a state or jurisdiction requires a paper receipt, that they have the technology and expertise to meet that requirement. David Dill, if it's so much better, why aren't people just asking for it and buying it? That is electronic voting with a paper receipt.
It seems to me that people are asking for it. Local election officials are sort of the least enthusiastic about this because I think they have a dream of being able to do recounts by pushing a button on the front of a computer. I'm question Diebold's sincerity a little bit. One of those memos suggests that they should charge prohibitive prices for these printers if they ever produce them. So
and
I'm not sure
what interest would they have in prohibitive pricing on those?
I don't know the answer to that question. That is not explained in the memo that I read on Scott's website.
Dan Tokaji, there's been a kind of a partisan debate around Diebold in particular and the politics of its CEO. You're in Ohio. What can you tell us about that?
Well, I know there have been a lot of concerns expressed about their background and so on, and some of those concerns may well have legitimacy. I honestly don't have firsthand information on that.
The chief executive there is a big Republican Party contributor. He's talked about committing Ohio to delivering its electoral votes for the president next year.
That's
but, of course, any business
stuff.
And, well, is it? I mean, he's a free American citizen. He can have political views. On the other hand, I guess he would have all the source code.
It depends on the context in which it's made, right? If it's in the context of talking about the voting system and we're going to rig this voting system in order to assure that the Republicans take Ohio, that's a real problem.
I'm sure it was not.
If it's in some other context, it might not be. But I think the underlying point is, yeah, we should do rigorous background checks of all voting system manufacturers, whether they're making touchscreens or some other kind of system. That doesn't mean that we have to hook up a printer, which, as we all know, has a tendency to jam to every single DRE machine. And Professor Dill, I think, acknowledged that an attached printer is not necessarily the only way to go when it comes to making touchscreens safer.
David Dill, what about our caller Donna's question? If electronic machines are good enough for banking, why not for voting? People do care a lot about their money.
That's a really good question. Computers are used in a lot of safety-critical applications. Banking is actually easier than voting because voting needs to throw away information. You need to conceal the identity of the voters, and you have to make sure that the voters can't prove how they voted to a third party to stop vote selling and coercion. So with banking in electronic transactions, you have the names of the people involved in those transactions everywhere, and it is my understanding from talking to some of the people who've endorsed our resolution on electronic voting, who are computer security people who work with banks, that banks keep paper backup for all of those transactions. It may not be true always, but it's true a lot of the time. So if these machines were acting like bank computers, they would keep a voter verifiable paper trail.
Gene's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Gene. You're on the air.
Yes. I hope you all know that the Sequoia software was accessed on the web. That just came out on the web.
This is another big electronic machine company based in California.
Senator Hagel of Nebraska, and Nebraska uses ESS machines, is a major owner of ESS. But what I really want to direct to is there was a London Independent article about what happened in Georgia in 2002 on October 16th. The connections on it on the web are ecotalk.org. ECOTALK.org. And really, the clear question for anyone in America, remembering Joe Stalin said, I don't care how people vote, I just want to count the votes. Well, if you truly believe in democracy, you want to have a secret ballot and an open, verifiable, auditable count.
And why can't computers not deliver that in your mind, Gene?
What's the audit trail? Look at Georgia in 2002. No audit trail. Take a look at that London Independent article about what happened in Georgia, what the polling showed. And I cannot prove that Georgia was stolen, and you cannot prove it wasn't stolen.
And there's a potential credibility problem. Gene, thanks for your call. David Dill, what about the audit trail? Why can't computers be programmed in such a way that a credible audit trail would be there?
It's just really, really hard to are we talking about an electronic audit trail?
Yes.
It's very hard to make, you know, if you're worried that the people who make the hardware or the people who write the software or somebody who has access to those designs could hack the system, it is very hard to make a trustworthy audit trail fully electronically. So the question, if you have an electronic record, it's hard to make it so you can't change it in the future. And it's so far as I can tell, impossible to make it so that somebody can view that electronic record without using a mechanism that's subject to being hacked.
Dan Takagi, that leaves us facing the possibility of a real kind of awful sci-fi scenario where the votes all go in, but people don't trust what comes out. You're saying the guardians at the polls have been good and they'll be good in the future. That will do it.
But that's not all I'm saying. I don't think there's any question that with any kind of system, paper-based or electronic, you've got to have rigorous security precautions in place. For DRE, that is for touchscreen machines, This means such things as multiple redundant backups, extensive logic and accuracy testing, parallel testing, meaning taking some of the machines out and actually doing dummy votes on them to make sure that they vote the way that they record votes the way they're supposed to. It means improving in some respects our testing and certification requirements. It may mean, and I'm curious for Dr. Dill's views on this issue. Hello?
Yeah, we're here.
Okay. It may mean seeing whether open source code works so that people like the MIT graduate student can take a look at the code and hunt around for any bugs or problems that might exist with it. But there are things we can do to make electronic voting safer.
David Dill, one word. We're out of time. Will open source code help or not here?
It's a good idea, but it won't solve the problem because you can't tell if that's the code running on the computers.
Well, stay tuned. Much more on this as America goes to the polls and moves ahead. Dan Takagi in Columbus and David Dill at Stanford University. Thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
David Dill, thanks for being with us. Listeners, you can continue online at onpointradio.org. In a moment, we'll go door to door with one of the candidates running in today's election. This is On Point. Many Americans who voted this election day have never met the candidates on the ballots. In an age when Arnold Schwarzenegger won California on a superstar name and $12 million in television ads, old-fashioned glad-handing, back-slapping, and baby-kissing can recall the politics of another era. No small number of voters in Somerville, Massachusetts, have met mayoral candidate Joe Curtatone at least once, and they've met him at their front door. In a densely populated city of triple-decker homes and a multi-ethnic population that stretches back generations, Joe Curtatone still did his campaign walk door-to-door. In this radio diary, On Point followed the candidate on an evening of knocking.
The best form of campaigning is one-on-one contact, meeting a person face-to-face, having a conversation, shaking their hands. That's the thing that sticks out the most in voters' minds. And you can't beat door knocking, as they say. You know, you get a good sense of how the voters are feeling, if there's any apathy towards you, if your message toward your literature, your other media components is resonating with the voters. We endorse sometimes, hey, I got your meal piece today, or I saw your ad, or I saw your endorsement.
Hello, come by to say hello. You know, the election's Tuesday for mayor, and we need your vote.
Yeah, I just received a letter from the AFMCD, the union.
Oh, good.
Yeah, yeah, good. Yeah.
AFL-CIO?
Yeah.
Endorsing me?
Yeah, I'll be with you.
All right. Yeah. All right. Oh, that's Bruno. Oh, he's a Brunacci, your son, Cal. How's he doing in school? He coaches his son in football.
Yeah, he's doing good now.
I start preparing my cards and everything. I look at my map in my office, and I start getting the streets, and I set a goal out the amount of streets I'm going to cover in that amount of time, and I go do it.
How you doing?
Hi.
Hi, I'm Joe Curtatone. Nice to meet you. I'm running for mayor. Just coming on the neighborhood to say hello.
Hello, you caught me at a funky time.
Oh, that's all right. You registered to vote?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, nice to meet you.
I can't.
Tell your friends, would you?
I'll let them know.
Thank you.
You know, Tip O'Neill said, former Speaker of the House, said all politics is local, and you want to get the vote, you got to make it local. You got to take it. It's very parochial. You got to go to the voters' door, and you got to knock on their door, tell them who you are and what you want to do, and introduce yourself. When they go to the ballot boxes, there's choices, and if they're undecided, hey, they're going to say, I remember the guy who knocked on my doorstep. Even for state seats, state senator, state rep seats, you should knock, absolutely. Even congressional streets, you should knock your districts, the major voting areas, absolutely. I mean, that's the biggest impression you can give on voters. You know, in national office, that's a different story. You don't see too many presidents door knocking. They might make a trip through a neighborhood, but you have such media attention and you use such mediums as television and radio. The thing that gets me pumped up the most is they come to know, hey, you're Joe Curtatone. Even if they don't kind of say they're going to vote you, they recognize it. That really tells me I'm out there and they know who I am.
Hi,
this is
Fury.
Hi, how you doing?
Joe Curtatone.
Yeah, sure. How you doing?
How are you?
Good.
Just making rounds around the neighborhood.
Okay, you got our votes.
I appreciate it very much.
No problem.
Thanks.
We said that last time you were here. Definitely. We're 100%.
I really appreciate it. We need you guys out there Tuesday.
All right.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
The door knocking is the best part. You get away from all the other monotonous... monotony and just get out, go to the door, tell people you are, ask them for your vote. It's the best form of campaign, and I enjoy it. So, and we're getting a great response. People, even the people at home, we leave a little note for them, tell them we're around. We'll get a call back at headquarters saying, hey, thanks for coming by my neighborhood. But people talk, neighborhoods talk, saying, hey, the candidate was around in my neighborhood last night, and they'll speak to somebody on the west side, or they're down my neighborhood last week, you know. So, you know, word gets around.
And you end up on the same situation one way or another. You don't pay it to the federal, but you pay it locally, so it's...
There's a cost of service.
It's kind of, you know.
Either way, you're going to end up paying somehow because there's a cost of service, okay?
But
the taxes, the reason the burdens...
We're out there. I judge by shoes. I'm on my third pair of shoes, so we're doing it. Yeah, they got some major holes in them, but I'm superstitious, so I plan on wearing them all the way to Election Day until the results come in. I won't take them off till the end.
Winding down. My dogs are aching.
You can't knock enough doors.
Janet, this doesn't look too good. There's a bunch of politicians out here.
We're back.
How are you doing?
Alderman-at-Large Joe Curtatone, who may or may not be elected mayor of Somerville, Massachusetts, tonight. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.